From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a memo from Catholic Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano. The Archbishop alleged that Pope Francis was part of a group of high-ranking Catholic leaders who knew about the long record of sexual abuse committed by another former Archbishop, Theodore McCarrick of Washington, D.C. Vigano claimed that the Pope repeatedly promoted and protected McCarrick from sanctions. And sadly, in the Catholic Church, that would be nothing new. The Church has paid billions of dollars in settlements with abuse victims. The Washington Post, for example, recently published some remarkably horrific details about abuse carried out against 1,000 children at the hands of 300 Catholic priests in the state of Pennsylvania alone. And what did church leadership do when many allegations would surface? Often, they would move the priest, allowing him to start anew in a different location. And that's why the allegation that Pope Francis might have done the same seemed credible. It's part of a long-running Catholic leadership playbook. And yet the allegations have brought forth a surge of calls almost immediately for Pope Francis's resignation. Many of those calls have come from Catholic writers who did not offer the same urgency before Francis was Pope. So what's going on here? New York Times writer Ross Douthat calls it a Catholic civil war. He says essentially that when Benedict and John Paul II were covering up sexual abuse, conservative Catholics put up with it because the popes reflected their own ideology. Now it's Francis accused of covering up, and conservatives are calling for his ouster. Liberals, on the other hand, have been more likely to defend Pope Francis. Douthat writes, quote, "They are running interference because Francis is their pope, the liberalizer they yearn for all through the John Paul and Benedict years, and all's fair in the Catholic Civil War," end quote. Catholic writer Damon Linker, in his regular column for The Week, declared that he is leaving the Catholic Church for good now. He wrote, quote, "To wade through the toxic sludge of the grand jury report, to follow the story of Theodore McCarrick's loathsome character and career, to confront the allegations piled up in Vigano's memo, it is to come face to face with monstrous, grotesque ugliness. It is to see the Catholic Church as a repulsive institution, or at least one permeated by repulsive human beings who reward one another for repulsive acts, all the while deigning to lecture the rest of the world about its sin. No thanks, I'm done, and I bet I'll have a lot of company headed for the door," end quote. So what's next for the Church? Can it heal from this? What's next for Pope Francis? And certainly, what's next for people who have been victimized? My guests today include Dr. Timothy Thibodeau, and he's a history professor at Nazareth College and an expert in many of these matters. Dr. Thibodeau, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Nora Bradbury Hale, an author, an interfaith youth worker, Catholic writer, and editor at St. Mary's Press. Nora, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
And Nancy Rourke is a professor of religious studies and theology at Canisius College, former director of the college's Catholic Studies program. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Hi, everyone.
I want to say, first and foremost, that we reached out to the Catholic Diocese of Rochester, and a couple of things about that. They declined to come on, and we reached out to a number of different institutions sort of related, St. Bernard's. We reached out to McQuaid. A lot of folks just told us they're not available today. And I accept that. I will also say that the Catholic Diocese of Rochester essentially never comes on this program to talk about this. And I don't fault the person running communications. That's Doug Mandolaro, who's a really good guy and a hardworking guy, and I've known him for many years. I think he's probably following orders. But since Bishop Metano arrived in Rochester, there's been very little communication publicly, at least with us. And, you know, maybe it's just us or maybe it's me. But that's disappointing to me because it's hard to have a conversation without that leadership. I know it's a sensitive subject, but I want our listeners to know we tried on this one. And I also think it's important for us to start with Dr. Thibodeau, who was kind of admonishing me as the host of this program to keep the victims first and foremost in mind here. So I'll start with you, Dr. Thibodeau.
That's correct. I think as we sit back here and reflect on what's been happening, and to politicize it and say, well, there's the liberal wing of the church versus the conservative wing, and they're battling for control of the papacy or they're battling for control of the hierarchy, takes our eyes off the primary focus. We're talking about the abuse of minors, and I'll just be very direct. We're talking about children being raped by men in authority over their lives, men of the clergy, and how this plays out as a political strategy for the left or the right, to me, is not nearly as relevant as honoring the victims and making sure something like this never happens again. I've spoken to some of those people that are victims, not for this particular broadcast, but I think they feel if we politicize this immediately, the lessons that we're supposed to learn from the abuse they suffered will be lost.
I appreciate that. And in that spirit, it's tough to read this, and it's probably tough to hear this, listeners. But let me go ahead and read a summary from the Washington Post of just a tiny sliver of what you'll find in a recent report's pages. This comes from Pennsylvania. In Erie, Pennsylvania, a 7-year-old boy was sexually abused by a priest who then told him he should go to confession and confess his sins to that same priest. Another boy was repeatedly raped from ages 13 to 15 by a priest who bore down so hard on the boy's back that it caused severe spine injuries. He became addicted to painkillers and later died of an overdose. One victim in Pittsburgh was forced to pose naked as Christ on the cross while priests photographed him with a Polaroid camera. Priests gave the boy and others gold cross necklaces to mark them as being groomed for abuse. That's from the Washington Post's recent report on what's going on in Pennsylvania. So, Dr. Thibodeau, I agree with you. We have to keep them in mind, and I don't want this conversation to ignore that. I think what it's trying to do is address some of the reality of what's going on and try to figure out, is there a way for this church to heal? I mean, Nora was saying before the hour began that you know Catholics in their 20s who have not ever known a Catholic church that this wasn't what it was in the public eye, whether it's late night comedy or, you know, lampooning the church and its ridiculous handling of these awful tragedies. I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's true.
Well, and it's interesting, as I have conversations about this topic, that generational split. You know, there one of my aunts jumped in on a social media conversation with a bunch of young people who've been in my youth groups over the years who are now in their 20s. And, you know, these aren't young people who were casual about their involvement with the church. These are, you know, the kid who was the substitute altar server so that when anybody else didn't show, they were there and, you know, just in church up to their elbows. So really highly invested young people. And some of them saying, you know, who had said in the past, you know, geez, I just don't feel like I can be Catholic anymore. We're starting to say, I don't think anybody should be Catholic anymore. This is so deeply immoral. This is such structural injustice. And so, you know, folks from different generations, older generations, were jumping in to say, well, but, you know, there's so many good and holy priests. And these young people don't want to hear it. They're just fed up. We had a chance to fix it. We didn't fix it. We you know, yes, so that, you know, there were dioceses here and there and our own. I was at the diocese in 2002 when Boston broke. Mm-hmm. And I was working there then, and we went through our files, we removed a bunch of priests, we published their names. That didn't happen in Buffalo. That didn't happen in Pennsylvania. And so, you know, especially those places where it didn't happen, It's really hard for youth and young adults to see that this is worth saving.
Nancy, is it worth saving?
Hmm. Can you define it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said so far. And it's interesting, among my students at Canisius College, some of them are like, yeah, what? Exactly like Nora was saying, this is not new, right? And others of them are still horrified because, you know, well, they're mostly raised and born in Buffalo area, where the situation is maybe a little sharper and difficult than it is in a lot of other dioceses. I think that it raises the question that is exactly the question that got muffed completely as a part of the symptoms leading to this problem. The question is this: what is the church? Like, what is it? Who is it? What does it mean? And for a lot of us, and I would include an awful lot of lay people, traditionally, the church is a bunch of bishops and priests. And that's been wrong, and that's incredibly wrong, and that's always been wrong. But it has benefited power, and it has benefited those of us to permit those in power to sort of be with God on our behalf in some bizarre way, to hold on to that belief. And we are seeing one of the many kinds of consequences that come from that, like clericalism, the abuse of power, and the tendency of the church to prioritize protecting itself. And I am not an expert on church history like Dr. Thibodeau at all, but it seems to me that when the church as a body and as individuals makes egregious errors and acts of horror and then hides them like this, it at the bottom of it is often the church is protecting itself, which indicates the church has forgotten the one thing that we can't forget. It's not ours. It's not in our power to continue it. And speaking as a Catholic here, the continuing of the church is not in the hands of humanity, much less in the hands of exclusively male humanity. It's a thing that God will continue or not, and we need to use it as a jumping off point for the purposes of living the way that God intends us, as I see it, not as an institution to be protected or shielded or fenced in or gate kept in any kind of a way. That's one of the many things that's gone wrong here. So the response, I think, should be attuned to that error.
Dr. Thibodeau.
Well, I speak as a historian, not as a theologian. And one of my impressions is the things that Francis has said publicly have really done more harm than good. To say the devil is at work trying to unmask the sins of the bishops smacks of a real kind of hierarchic clericalism. And the other thing, I'm interested in solutions. And if you think back to the fact that the church had an ecumenical council called the Second Vatican Council more than 50 years ago, and I grew up as a Vatican II Catholic. The discussion was the church is the people of God. It's not the clerical elite. This is a case where the people of God have no practical power. You're talking to three lay people, okay? I'm not a member of the clergy. We're all highly educated. We bring to this conversation a level of expertise and passion for what we do. Why not tap some of that brain power and use some of that expertise? I find it ironic that the Pope is having all these, the heads of bishops' councils come to Rome in February. Mm. So you're going to have a bunch of men who are part of the problem discussing what could be a possible solution. If the Pope has any courage, maybe he would tell all of these bishops, I want you each to have a synod in your diocese. I want you to bring in psychologists, medical professionals, social workers, historians, theologians, ethicists. Or let's go bold. Why not have a Vatican III? I think it's long overdue to have some kind of ecumenical response to this. Because, Evan, you and I a year ago sat in the studio talking about the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation and the sale of indulgences, the sale of pieces of paper. We're talking about a spiritual holocaust on young people. And the numbers and the things that you read where you're overcome with emotion. I'm a parent. I have two grown children. And when I think of them, having gone through Catholic education, Catholic schools, and I think of all the good people that surrounded them, but I don't know who all the bad ones were, okay? And I may never know to whom they were exposed. So I have I'm a professor of history. I have expertise in this. I published on this. But I also have a kind of human moral outrage that this I would call a spiritual holocaust that needs to be addressed and not forgotten.
And that's why some of what some observers would call sort of the political fissure does matter. And this is at least from my observation. It's because when you think about the victims, and yeah, it was difficult to read what's happened to kids without getting emotional. When you think about the actual children, the actual human beings, not a statistic, not a number on a page, not a left versus right, these are kids. When you think about that, if we are in a position, Dr. Thibodeau, where the solution turns out, or the ostensible solution is the forced resignation of a pope, the selection of an assumedly more conservative pope, if that causes any large number of Catholics to say, well, good enough, we fixed it. That was then nobody ever cared about those kids. But similarly, if we have liberal-leaning, sort of Francis-liking largely, and I'm really generalizing here, but Catholics who really like at least some of the social direction of the church, doctrine or not, and them saying, well, the ends justify the means. We can't risk losing this pope.
Right.
Then
right.
You're not protecting the kids either.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm just a quick response here. It's more than one man. I mean, we're talking about institutional structures that are rooted in a church that goes back to the Middle Ages. An analogy I gave to another media outlet with whom I spoke is I'm a college professor, and my college has a board of trustees. And the Board of Trustees supervises the work of the faculty. They study the finances. They make sure we're fulfilling our mission. That was the original function of the College of Cardinals going back to the Middle Ages. They were like a presidential cabinet, a kind of Board of Trustees for the church that ended up electing the Pope for the last 1,000 years. Well, maybe that doesn't work. Maybe you have some kind of oversight body in each diocese or archdiocese where you have lay people with expertise. They have a voice. They have some kind of control. They have some kind of participation in the vetting or the oversight of things.
But how? Because power protects power, as you know, Dr. Thibodeau, and they'd have to cede some of that to lay people like yourself and Nancy and Nora and any number of people. Who's going to do that?
Well, we could appoint cardinals who are not priests. That can happen today. Actually, several of us on Twitter and Facebook have begun a list, your eminences, if you are listening, of our preferred choices. Any woman, any Catholic can be appointed a cardinal according to canon law. That's a possibility. I don't know that it would solve
the clericalism. How many women cardinals are there?
I don't believe, we don't really do that. I don't even know
zero,
if any are not priests.
Give or take zero.
Yes, give or take, I mean, plus or minus.
The history isn't good, but you're saying at least canon law allows it.
Yes.
Okay.
It could happen
Doors
today.
Doors open.
Yes. Well, is the door open or not? That's the thing. So I don't know if that would solve the clericalism problem, but the introduction of women into the structures of power of maintaining and, you know, keeping an eye on the church from within, why not? And aside from why not, we are seeing daily more and more reasons why it ought to be happening.
Okay. Nora?
So
is the door open, I guess? Yeah, go ahead.
So it's possible. Is it likely, probable? You know, I don't see that happening. I wanted to return to the idea that there's nobody here from the diocese, and I think that, you know, this just paints such a great picture of how far outside the conversation lay people actually are on this. I no longer work for somebody whose boss is the bishop. But I should also say that I speak for myself, not for my company here. And the fact is that if you are a lay person and you say the wrong thing in public, you can lose your job like that. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, lay people in ministry don't have big savings accounts. So, you know, the idea that nobody can put their job on the line, and that's what we're doing if we speak up, if we speak out as lay ministry. I was a lay ecclesial minister in the church for 28 years, and it's a very vulnerable position to be in.
It sounds rather authoritarian.
Yes.
It is.
And the other thing I want to add to this conversation about that is just how insular the world of our bishops and the world of our cardinals actually is. They're not having the conversations with, very few of them are having the conversations with youth and young adults that I'm having, that I'm sure you all are having with your students. Everyone's polite to them. Anytime there's a conversation between and among Catholics and bishops, it's always moderated. The bishops are always protected. The cardinals are always protected. So the idea, and I got to tell you, I love Pope Francis. I'm one of those lefty Francis lovers. But when I read what he said, that he was offering in this moment of the church, he was offering sympathy to the bishops.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Trying to comfort them in that homily, I was like, you have got to be kidding me. And he's somebody, you know, he's more in touch than, you know, anybody we've seen in power in a long time. He knows how to talk to young people. He knows how to speak in sound bites and speak the language of the people. But when I saw that, I was just really disheartened.
Yep. Well, could I respond to that? I am, as a historian, I don't love or hate any particular pope. And I would not categorize myself as a Francis lover. I think he's a natural with the media. And the spontaneous press conference on the papal airline, you know, he mastered, where he just says, who am I to judge and who am I to do
you,
this?
You mean the whole song and dance where he says something and then the second the plane lands, they say, all the people around him say, that's not doctrine.
No.
Just
well,
so
but
you know.
So, here's the problem. I can't sit in a position to judge him morally, but I think he has participated in evil. I mean, I think there's no other way to say that. Cardinal McCarrick is a rotten person. And to have him, I want to remind your listeners that McCarrick, a cardinal elects a pope, and that man helped elect Francis, and he himself could have been elected pope if, I don't remember if he was the right age. And according to media pundits who cover Catholic press, McCarrick was one of the people walking around the conclave saying, hey, you should take a look at the man who now is Pope Francis, and he helped garner support. So there's that point. Then the second thing is the disconnect between these spontaneous impromptu moments of charisma and reaching out to youth. The catechism is still the catechism. Humanae Vitae is still the doctrine of the church. Same-sex relationships are still condemned by the catechism. And what I find interesting, people that I know that are gay who try to be faithful Catholics, you can't express any sign of love. You're committing a grave error or sin. When at the same time, Cardinal McCarrick expressed a lot of affection in same-sex relationships that were abuse of power and abuse of human rights, going back to a credible account involving an 11-year-old boy. So that part of me, you know, I'm very disturbed by that. And this is where I try to say, even if you get another pope in, right, it could be a conservative. It could be someone who's not as progressive or maybe equally progressive. That really doesn't matter that much. If the system stays the same, it doesn't matter who's at the top.
If we're keeping our eyes on protecting children, that's exactly right. That is exactly right. You can call for the ouster of any pope, whether you're a progressive who doesn't like a conservative pope or the opposite. But if that's all it's about to you, it doesn't matter. And I don't know how, whoever the next pope is, whoever the next leadership is, how we get around this notion of sort of comforting the bishops first or protecting the power and covering up. And it was 2002, right, Nora?
When
16 years. And here we are today. And if I sound angry, these are the things that get me angry, is kids being victimized and all of the apologists, whether it's political or I don't know, all of the reasons kids have been abused. And yeah, I'm a little angry that the Catholic Diocese of Rochester isn't here today. And I love Doug Mandolaro, and I don't know the bishop, and I met him one time. But where are you? Go ahead, Nora. I'm sorry.
I'm right there with you, Evan. Having worked with young people back before Boston, I went through the process of coming forward with a victim who had come to me, and all of those problems. You know, I will say in our diocese, our process for coming forward and the way that we have behaved since Boston and the Dallas Charter is incredibly improved. I will say that, but I will also say that in 2002 we skipped almost the most important step. I mean, the most important step was getting those guys out of ministry, and by those guys I mean the guys that were still walking around in collars. They may have been, you know, banished to a basement office someplace or, you know, off in a rectory, but
not good
people
enough.
Still called them father. Yeah. But the next most important step was accountability for bishops. And I always say when we're talking about this issue, people understand. They understand that there are predators in the world and in every walk of life. What they do not understand and what they find unconscionable and what these next generations coming up just cannot tolerate is the idea that there were people who knew and they let it continue. Mm-hmm. And we have never called our bishops to accountability for that.
Mm. Even now.
Even now. Mm-hmm. Even now. There are bishops in our nation and around the world, as we just saw in Germany, who moved priests when they were younger, who covered things up, who knew about files that were in the basement and shredded them. And there's been no calling to account for that. And only when lay people have discovered that or leaked it, or and so I feel like that's, you know, that's the second most important step, and we skipped it.
Let me just say, I see the phone starting to ring, and I want to welcome some feedback from listeners. I know, Nora, you've been sort of polling some of the people you interact with just about what they'd like to see addressed or sort of how, and we'll get to that in our second half hour. We'll take some phone calls in just a moment. You can email the program connections at wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You know, Nancy Rourke made the point earlier this hour that maybe a way to move forward is to bring more women into positions of leadership and to start that. Think about, juxtapose that with what Nora is telling us about sort of a pretty close to authoritarian bent that the church hierarchy has had about just talking publicly. And forget the question of whether women in positions of leadership could help with a sex abuse scandal. Just talk about women's ordination. 4 years ago, we wanted to talk about it in this program. You know how many people told me, Evan, I would love to talk to you. I'd be out of a job tomorrow if the church heard me say that. There's a lot of people who told me that. And you're
I was one of them.
I think you were one of them.
Yeah.
You know, so and that's just on the subject of ordination. That's outside of the sensitive subject of a sex abuse scandal. So I don't know what we do about this. I don't. I'm heartsick about it. But we got to get our only break of the hour. Let's take our only break. We're going to come back to your phone calls. You're hearing Dr. Timothy Thibodeau, who's a history professor at Nazareth College, Nora Bradbury Hale, an author, interfaith youth worker, and a Catholic writer, and an editor at St. Mary's Press, Nancy Rourke, professor of religious studies and theology at Canisius College. Your phone calls and feedback on the subject of what happens next in the Catholic Church, next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Wall Street Journal reports that for the first time, young U.S. drinkers, we're talking age 21 to 27, are choosing wine and spirits over beer. Are we slowly breaking up with beer? Well, here in Rochester, it's hard to believe that's true with the vibrant craft beer scene, from the brewers to the bars. The question is, what's the real truth on the drinking scene? We explore it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about what's going on in the Catholic Church and, you know, the so-called Catholic Civil War that everyone from Ross Douthat in the pages of the New York Times to other Catholic writers have described regarding what to do about the allegations regarding Pope Francis, other Catholic leadership, new allegations regarding former Archbishop McCarrick. Juxtapose that with the Washington Post recent report from Pennsylvania, which looked like it could have been out of Boston 16 years ago, and it just feels endless. It just feels endless. And our guests are trying to help lead us forward today. We did reach out to the Catholic Diocese, and they once again declined to join this conversation. Let's work through some of your feedback at 844-295-TALK is the number. Kate in Penfield first. Go ahead, Kate.
Hey there. Okay, so I was just thinking about the Pope's comment about being merciful. I can't remember exactly what he said about the bishops, but while I have two boys and I think it's horrid to shelter anyone that's committing egregious crimes or sins, it does seem kind of like a Christ-like stance to maybe have a more God-like view of even the worst sinners. I don't know.
Okay. Nora, you were most critical of Pope Francis's offering some sympathy for the bishop. So what do you make of that, what Kate's saying there?
So one of the things that I would love to see our bishops and the hierarchy do is to really distinguish between a sin and a crime. So if we talk about the sin aspect of that, Kate, you're exactly right. We teach as a church that there's nothing you could do that would make God stop loving you. And that's absolutely true. It's why Jesus came. It's why we're all saved, you know, and I believe in God's goodness and mercy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that's the sin part of sexual abuse. But then there's the criminal part. There's the abuse of power part. And that's the part that we have just failed, fallen down on. We have not held people accountable. And when you look at what Jesus says in the Gospels, when Jesus really gets his dander up, when he starts flipping tables, when he calls people you brood of vipers, he's talking to people in power who have abused their power. So when, you know, when I think of what would Jesus do in this instance, I think he would take care of business. And I really feel like he would change the structures. And you know, we say we believe in the power of the Holy Spirit, that this public reckoning that we're going through right now, that may just be what it takes.
Mm-hmm. You want to add to that, Dr. Thibodeau?
Well, I want to respond to that question. First off, I don't think we'd be having this discussion if it were not for district attorneys and law enforcement officials and the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. The church, the hierarchy, has done everything they possibly can to hide and conceal this pattern of abuse, not only of human beings, but of power. So my hat is off to the brave people, men and women in law enforcement and criminal justice, who say justice must be done and the perpetrators must be held accountable. My second remark would be, you could have a woman, or you could have anyone in an abusive relationship being battered, and let's say a husband is beating his wife. I guess I can feel sorry for the abuser, but my number one priority is to make sure the person that's being abused is removed from that relationship. I come at this as a historian. I don't really come at it as a theologian. And I read the Pope's original statement, the letter he released about 4 weeks ago, and it was long on words and short on any kind of practical solutions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nancy?
Yeah. Those in power abuse power, but the church has a unique contribution to give to that problem, which is the understanding of humanity. And it has something to do with sin, is how I would put it. And the reality is that any one of us in a position with sufficient power would abuse our power eventually. That's the nature of human sinfulness. So although there is a letter going around inviting the U.S. bishops as a body to resign, and I have signed it, and I think that may be a number one first step that is a minimal requirement for what needs to happen next, it isn't the full solution, because the church has not, as a body, theologically reckoned with the reality of sin and the intersection between power and sex. Power, sex, sexuality, and gender, the church has an inadequate understanding of it, which is a big problem for a body that claims to be, among all things, an expert in humanity, which is a quote that appears in encyclicals all over the place and is the reason the church feels that we have the authority and the obligation to speak to so many different moral issues. We are an expert in humanity, right? But without an adequate understanding of the meaning of sex, sexuality, or gender and genders, and of the nature of power and how they intersect, we will not get past this.
Yeah, that's where the Damon Linker essay really stood out to me when he talked about why he's leaving the Catholic Church now. He says, the institution is one permeated by repulsive human beings who reward one another for repulsive acts, all the while deigning to lecture the rest of the world about its sin. And that hypocrisy is probably going to be fatal if there's not a solution here. Mm-hmm. The phones have lit up. We're going to get back to your calls in just a moment here. And I want to continue to sort of weigh what our listeners want to talk about with this. We welcome all different perspective, and this is not sort of an easy call. Before the hour's out, I will ask all three of our guests what they're hoping people will do, whether it's sort of rank-and-file Catholics or Catholic leadership, or both. But let me get back to those calls now, and Cliff in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah, okay, very good. Well, I was just driving down the expressway, heard this program on, and I said, boy, I can't wait to get home because I'm going to call in about this. And I happen to feel very strongly I'm calling on all Catholic women to get together and do something about your church. Now, my wife was a Catholic, and she got fed up 25 years ago and left the church. I was not Catholic. I'm a lay person, I guess. But all these years, I am always sitting around the dining table. Why don't the Catholic women sit up and yell and scream and holler? And that's about all I need to say. I'm very supportive of the comment that one of your guests said about the meeting in Rome where I can't think of it. Not Cardinal. Who's the main?
The Pope.
Oh, the Pope.
Yes.
Yeah, I can't think of the word Pope. Sorry about that.
You must not be Catholic, Cliff.
I'm not. Well, it was great, the suggestion that he's really not getting it when he calls a meeting and has no laymen or laywomen in the meeting.
Yeah, indeed. Cliff, thank you. And I think I'll just turn it over to the Catholic women here, but I would say he's calling for the Catholic women to get up, stand up, maybe walk out. Probably not just going to take lay women, probably going to take a lot of people involved here, mm-hmm. Nancy.
Yeah, a lot of us have been. A lot of us have been. There's been plenty of screaming women. I would agree we need more. And I want to reaffirm and reiterate the point Nora made, whereby the women who are committed to Catholicism, and there are so many, they're everywhere, and the women who have jobs working with Catholic diocese or working with Catholicism who can't stand up and scream on the fear of losing their jobs, that's endemic. And I run into it in so many places in both the diocese where I work. Yes, but maybe more organized, dramatic action among the women in particular. Women religious have been taking the leadership on that, and certainly they have been punished over and over and over again, but they keep standing up.
One of the best suggestions I've been in a conversation around so far is for the bishops to step down and for our women religious to take over the administration of all the dioceses in the United States. We have some incredible women religious right here in our diocese. You know, my favorite people are our women religious, the nuns here, and you know, our sisters are just the best people in the church, but they are not part of the hierarchy. I mean, people are surprised to find out how little women religious.
I think non-Catholics are always surprised at that.
Yeah, yeah. You mean the nuns don't run things? Nope. They ran your school maybe, but they don't have a voice in the hierarchy except as advisors, except as in conversation.
Invited guests. Exactly. They ran your kid's school with an iron but loving fist. What would they do with actual power in the church? That's a great point. Back to your phone calls, Ted and Webster next. Go ahead, Ted.
Yes, I'm a psychologist, and it just seems to me I can't understand how the Catholic Church can turn their back away from the fact that a man needs a mate, and the priesthood. This whole thing could be reduced tremendously if a priest were permitted the right to select his love and have a normal relationship with somebody, rather than be put in a box and say, you can't think this way. You're bad. Hmm. You can't think this way. You've got to change your thinking. That is not going to work, because we're all humans, Evan, and we need to reckon with that fact.
Yeah, Ted, thank you for that. And before I let the panel respond to your phone call, let me get Bobby next on the phone, who's got a sort of a similar line of thinking. Go ahead, Bobby.
Hello. I thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I have a solution to this, and that is married priests. And why not? Sex in marriage is not a sin. You are not better than thou because you don't have sex. And I married a priest. And he was so certain, and this was in the 70s, early 70s, he was so certain that that very soon priests would be allowed to marry. But he left the priesthood to marry. We have two wonderful children. What is wrong with that? I will never leave the Catholic Church for this, but I do hope that the time comes when married priests are acceptable.
Ted, Bobby, thank you. Similar veins there. Nora, how significant? Or Dr. Tibb, you want to start? Dr. Tibbitt is going to start with this one.
Yeah, just a little bit of historical perspective, because my students ask me about this. Where does celibacy come from? Mm-hmm. In the Latin or the Western Roman Church, it's about a 1,000-year-old practice. And it's predicated on two things in the Middle Ages. One is, there was a fear that if the parish priest were married and he had children, his son would become the next priest. So the technical legal term is alienation of property. I think more important, though, is, and I've written about this actually, is the concept of ritual purity. That is, there's a long tradition within monasticism in the Middle Ages, which really flourished at about the time the College of Cardinals was invented and popes were elected by cardinals, that if a man has sexual relations with a woman, the term they would use is he's defiled himself and then can no longer stand at the altar and consecrate the body of Christ. So the tradition is already there for married clergy, even in the Roman Church for the first 1,000 years. But I don't know if that's the solution in and of itself, because this is more than sex. This is also about power. And I think when you look at people that are predators, and by the way, the level of predation in the general population is also significant. And if you look at what psychologists call pedophilia, a lot of the people that engage in that are actually married. So they're not celibate. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to kind of disentangle these things and be mindful that we're talking about power, we're talking about power relationships and authority and power and sexuality as a kind of toxic mix of things in the hands of the wrong people. This is why I do think it's important to have women and men and lay people and a whole bunch of people across the spectrum with training in psychology and social work and medicine and ethics be part of the conversation and not just have a room full of bishops. I found it amazing, finally, that the Archbishop of New York, Cardinal Dolan, who's a very charming, charismatic, seems like a good man, defended Cardinal Wuerl and recently said, gee, you know, I hope the guy doesn't resign. Of course, Cardinal Wuerl's the Archbishop now of Washington, who's implicated. He really should resign, right? He offered his resignation to the Pope for canonical reasons for his age a couple of years ago. But Cardinal Dolan, please, here you are saying something like that. It speaks to the insularity that we've talked about. Bishops talking to bishops is not a solution. It's a continuation of the problem.
I got more phone calls. Nancy, Nora, do you have a view on if marriage is part of the solution to this whole thing that our callers seem to think?
I think indirectly, maybe. The John Jay report reiterated what Dr. Thibodeau has said, which is that there is no correlation among priests who have assaulted children like this and priests and celibacy and of other lay people in the church who have also abused power to the extent of assaulting and outside of Catholicism. And I have experience with this in Protestant churches as well. But the necessity of keeping women away from the church and protecting men from interacting with, you know, female persons in all these ways is definitely related to some of the abuses of power that we've seen and to the assaults on children that we've seen.
Nora?
And I think what celibacy does in the modern era to the church is it narrows our pool in a way that's really unhealthy. And so, I agree with everything that's been said so far, but would just add that aspect of things that when a young person or an older person these days comes forward and is interested in ordination, who is willing to do that, who is willing to come forward and say that is a much narrower pool because of celibacy.
Kat writes to the program and says, in response to the caller earlier who was saying, urging Catholic women to stand up and sort of revolt, Kat says, just another, I'm guessing, white man who thinks it's a woman's job to clean up men's indoctrinated habits. Men, take responsibility. I'm eye-rolling all over the place. That's from Kat. Ruth in Rochester emails to say, it seems to me that the long history of systemic abuse and the protection of abusers being uncovered would be talked about completely differently if it was from a different place than the Catholic Church, even if this was a different denomination. This would be called what it is, a child sex ring. I understand that the diocese is a giant, unwieldy beast that takes a long time to change, but I wonder if that means this is just the end of the church and maybe it's time. Gary writes to us and says, why do the women on your panel stay committed to the Catholic Church? There are plenty of Christian churches they would fit right in. Is it just they are simply socially conditioned to stay? All right, Nora and Nancy. Nancy, you kind of flinched a little.
Oh, feeble-minded. Okay, no, I hear what he's saying, and that is the truth. And I am not one of those Catholics who believe that Christ resides only in Catholicism by any stretch, or even only in Christianity, which I guess is another week's topic. But for me, the reason that I stay in the church is because it's big. The Catholic Church is big. So for me, I want a big church. I want a church with a wide variety of dedicated people who can demonstrate all different ways of doing faith and a wide variety of theologies. And in Catholicism, that is what I see. Participation in the sacraments with people I love and agree with and people I just don't like and disagree with, but having to make myself go back there and eat of the same thing and take in the same thing as what they're taking in is so good for me, and it makes me crazy, but I know that I need it. That's a good enough answer for now.
Okay,
have I been asked this question once or twice? But and if you know, if the church were the hierarchy, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it would be easy to walk away, right? We could just say, oh, these guys are out of touch, I'm out of here. But it's not. It's and whenever I'm having trouble with the top of the church, I always go to the bottom, you know. And boy, do I love the bottom of the church. You know, I think of Sister Grace Miller and the House of Mercy, and I think of James at the House of Hospitality at St. Joe's Catholic Worker, and I think of all the amazing work that has been done and continues to be done by loving, committed Catholics who manifest God in so many ways. And I think the great tragedy here is that these upcoming generations are having the beauty of that stolen away from them.
Mm-hmm. Another way to answer it in my mind lately has been, it's mine. What are you doing? It's mine. I'm not leaving.
that's a shorter and more direct way of saying
it.
You're not forcing me out of something that's mine. Dr. Thibodeau.
Yeah, one response to this, and obviously I'm not a woman in the church who can stand up and scream. The bishop is a monarch. The pope is a monarch. It is not a democracy. And so I can give the bishop all kinds of feedback and input and ideas, and these talented women with all their expertise and their knowledge. The bishop can decide whether or not a lay person can preach. The bishop can decide whether a female can carry an altar, carry a processional cross, or serve at the altar. So the bishop still has hegemony in his diocese, and we can have all the goodwill, and we can have all the prayer and fasting and great ideas, but in the end, it is not a democratic process. And you say, well, what would a democracy look like? Evan, you and I talked about this. It was called the Protestant Reformation. that is, there came a point where Christians said the system is so broken and so resilient in defending itself that we'll move in a new direction, which is a Presbyterian model or an Episcopal model or something like that. So I would go back to what I said about 45 minutes ago. The church should call a council. I mean, this is all of these things.
Vatican III.
It's time. All of these things that we've discussed here in the last hour, they're all interconnected. Power, clericalism, structure, et cetera, whether or not there's a people of God. And in this council, it would not just be cardinals and bishops, but we would have expertise of other people, of other walks of life.
I wish I had another hour. Down to our last 90 seconds, I'm going to take that as Dr. Thibodeau's sort of closing admonition, a call for a Vatican III. Right. Nancy, what do you want the lay people of the church, and what do you want the leadership to do here?
I would like to see the U.S. bishops offer their resignation as a body, as an act of actual penitence. I would like to see lay people start stepping up and taking leadership in the church, and for the priests in individual dioceses to find within themselves the courage to permit actions like that at the risk of being in trouble with their own bishops. And I would like to see women assume leadership in the church in so many ways, and a rehauling of formation of seminaries and seminarians. First start?
That's a good start. It's a short list. Nora?
Just quickly, I would love to see lay people given real power at this meeting coming up in February to actually change the church.
Mm. That was very direct. And so I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds. You've heard from a number of people you've been interacting with through your various social media. Are they feeling sort of that same urgency that something must change?
Something must change. The structure of the church has to change. And I guess I just want to give these last few seconds to the brave people who have come forward and to the brave people who have stayed silent, who have survived sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And, you know that there are many, many people who stand with you and who love you and who care about what happened to you.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that. Nancy and Nora, would you ever leave the this is sort of an easy, like a yes or no, because what Gary was wondering is, you know, how come you haven't left the church? Is this a forever, you're in this forever, you're always going to work to change it, or could you get to a point where you're done?
I don't know. If I go, it's going to be with a bang, hopefully not soon, and I don't see it coming.
I'm with Nancy on that.
I want to thank our guests for being here. Difficult but important conversation. Nancy Rourke, Professor of Religious Studies and Theology at Canisius College. Always nice to see you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Nora Bradbury Hale, an author, interfaith youth worker, Catholic writer, and editor at St. Mary's Press. Thank you, Nora.
Thanks, Evan.
Dr. Timothy Thibodeau. Dr. Thibodeau is a professor of history at Nazareth College. Thank you, Dr.
Thanks,
Thibodeau.
Evan.
We'll see if there's a Vatican III in the offing. There's a lot of tough stuff to come here. All right. Much more connections. Come on.